Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program today is the Exploratorium, a learning laboratory for the 21st century. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Sydney Kohara, our Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist, who will be our moderator and introduce our panel. Sydney?
Thank you so much, and it is such a pleasure to be here. How many of you have had a chance to see the new Exploratorium? Wow. This crowd already knows what we're going to be talking about, and we're so happy that you are here. I'd like to introduce our speakers today, two people who have been intimately involved in the process of creating this new Exploratorium, or should I say the old Exploratorium in a brand new space, in a brand new way. Mark Letalian is the design principal with EHDD, and Sean Lanny is the senior artist with the Exploratorium. Mark, you have been an architect with EHDD for 23 years.
Yes.
Sean, you have been with the Exploratorium for 18 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This program, this building, I understand, this idea, this project has been in the works for both of you 8 to 10 years. I want to ask both of you as we start so that the audience can get to know you a little bit. Sean, I'll start with you. What, throughout your career, brought you to this place, the Exploratorium, and this new project?
Well, I was actually brought to this place as a kid by my grandmother. We were over in San Leandro, and we would go over. I was probably 6 or 7 years old, and the wonderful thing about the Exploratorium is many of the memories are based not on the exhibits as much as what happens there, and what happens there is with the person that you are with or the people that you meet there. So the social interactions, those memories are generated. It's fun, and it's kind of, you look back as at the Exploratorium as kind of one of your favorite places to go with one of your favorite people. And so after I went to college and I got a museum degree in museum studies, I was always in love with museums, probably starting there, as organizations, as cultural institutions. And when I saw the job posting for the museum, I thought, oh, I have to go back there. I just have to go back. And I didn't exactly know why. And it ended up, of course, I've been there 18 years now, so clearly I like it. But I didn't exactly know why, but I think in those memories was such a joy that I felt drawn to it. And then I felt kind of, it was my job to kind of make sure that kept happening, to preserve that experience.
And Mark, this is not your first project in a museum-like setting. Tell us a little bit about your journey to the Exploratorium.
Well, I didn't grow up here in the Bay Area, so I don't have stories like Sean to talk about, you know, my first experience as a child at the Exploratorium. But I was visiting the Palace of Fine Arts when I first moved to San Francisco, and I was visiting Maybeck's Big Rotunda. The day I was there, the big doors, which are never open, I don't know why they were open that day, were open, and I got a peek inside to this wonderful place, and that thereby began my curiosity of the Exploratorium. At the time, I had just started my job at EHDD, and I was already designing aquariums and museums, so I was a likely candidate to someday be involved. A year later, we were involved in a design charrette, where we were brought together with artists and landscape architects, and three teams competed for ideas about how to transform the Palace of Fine Arts for the evolving Exploratorium. And that turned into a project we did at the Palace of Fine Arts. Then the decision was made for them to move. I was out of the picture for a while, and I came back in 2006 when this project that we're talking about today started.
The Exploratorium's mission is to change the way the world learns. So tell me, how did that guide the design process for both the architecture and the exhibits?
Well, at the base of our learning is an engagement. It's an initial engagement. And there's a joy in that engagement where learning can then happen. And so when we went to the new site, there were so many opportunities that it afforded us. We had a view outdoors. We had new gallery spaces that we could work on as groups and as smaller groups with curators with a kind of more intense focus. So with 2 and 3 years to develop these areas, it's really been an exceptional journey towards watching the place evolve. Not necessarily, it's not a revolution, it's an evolution of the place. And so we've been building slowly over the years, and it feels like this really focused our attention and made us consider, you know, when you have a new building, the opportunities that space affords, it also forces a consideration of who you are and who do you want to be. And so in the process of figuring that out, we work with Mark to help him express the kind of environment that might support those kinds of activities.
I know, Mark, there were a number of spaces that the Exploratorium was looking at. When they finally decided on a pier, and a dilapidated pier, on San Francisco's Embarcadero, to develop it, put it together, what were your thoughts? And what was your thinking when you went into this project? What did you want to accomplish?
I think for us, the great opportunity here was that for the first time, Exploratorium was going to have an outdoor presence. They never had that at the Palace of Fine Arts. And here we get this opportunity to build literally on the front porch of the city, a site 3 times as big, 2 piers with this great space between them. It really gave us an opportunity to look at how that identity would be manifest on the outside, and how the architecture responds to the exhibit. And this is the thing that Sean and I worked on a lot together in the process, that jointly we developed between the landscape, the exhibits, the art, the architecture, an environment of inquiry where none of those elements takes precedence over the other. It's one kind of cohesive experience.
You two sound like kids in a candy store, having this wonderful space, this wonderful opportunity to be so creative. For our audience, let's go ahead and describe some of the the magnitude of the space we're working with. I've been told that it's almost the size of 2 football fields. Mark, you talk about it being, what, the size of a New York City block?
Yeah, it's the pier, when you go to the end of the pier, it's 820 feet from the seawall or from the Embarcadero, and it feels very different out there because you're out in the bay. And as designers, it took us a while to grasp the scale of this place, because we start working with very tiny drawings, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And when you start to visit the pier, you realize how immense the place is.
Yeah, the strategy for us outdoors was to create these kind of bracketing experiences. So there's a southeast corner that's beautiful. It kicks out. And so in that corridor there, we laid in 5 of these big discs that are samples from the bay floor. And so as you spin these discs, you kind of animate what you see in the water, or what you don't see in the water, which is the sediments from various parts of the bay. And we have exhibits placed around the entire site because we knew we couldn't fill it. We knew we couldn't animate the entire site. But to bracket those places, especially in the public area, the unticketed spaces, was a way for us to send the message, like, this whole site might surprise you, this whole site.
I think the thing, when I saw it, that most amazed me, the idea of the space and the light and the openness of it.
Yeah.
Were you ever concerned about actually filling it?
Well, we're never going to be finished. And I think that it's such a wonderful thing to have a little more space. You know, most of us don't have a little more space. We run out of space pretty quick. And the sense there is that it's still a very expansive experiment. What might we do there? What might we do there? The space is literally air. It's the void between the buildings. And we have bridges that come across the middle, and we fill that with Nakaya's piece. Fujiko Nakaya is an artist we brought in, and she fills the bridge with fog, and the fog kind of slowly expands over every half hour for 5 minutes it runs. Slowly expands, and if you're on the bridge, you become engulfed in the fog. You can't even see, so the person you were standing next to a moment ago is gone. And if the wind comes up, all of a sudden it clears and they're back again. So it's a really wonderful experience. It could only happen in those kinds of spaces.
That central space was really important as we were planning the project, because the ability for the public to be able to get to the end of the pier is paramount, and it was required. And we worked with a big group. Gary Strang, the landscape architect, was part of our team, and we really looked at what we call desire lines in the business that look at, you know, what's the best way somebody's going to get to the end of the pier, the most natural way. And for those of you who have been there, the pier that has the fog on it that Sean was just describing is kind of at an angle, and it really is conducive to people really flowing around the site. They get to experience the exhibits of the Exploratorium and get to experience the entire space. They get to the end, there's a restaurant that's open to the general public. But it's that flow and ability to go around the entire pier that is really important. So I want everybody to know that. I was on site the other day, and somebody came up to me and said, are we allowed to go there? It's like, absolutely. It's open to the public, and you need to experience it.
It's an unusual experience. You know, many times at the beginning of the museum, I've heard this actually quite often, a parent will come in with a child, and the child will pause, and they'll say, I can touch anything. It's like, yeah, you can touch anything. It's all there.
It is so interesting how you really blur the lines between a building and the bay, you know, the form, the fluidity. But this really goes back, Sean, right, to why the Exploratorium was started in the first place. Talk about the idea that the founder, Frank Oppenheimer, had for this building, what he wanted to accomplish, and why it's come sort of, it's a reality now from a dream with this new building.
Yeah, it's an interesting journey. I think people often think of the Exploratorium as a place where you learn. And I think Frank saw the place as it was more about self-efficacy, which is the notion that you can learn. You're in control of your own.
Was this 1949? Did he?
1969.
69, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And so what happened at that point, there was a revolution going on in American educational systems, and there was a sense of empowerment political as well. It was a very political movement. And so when Frank started the museum, it was about science, but it was also about art. It was about ways of knowing the world. And so as a founding maneuver, it was interactive, but it was also interactive to the way we weren't trying to show you something. We weren't setting something up for you to learn. We were setting up something that you could explore and that would then give you answers by that experience. And so when you think about, if you fast forward to today, and we have environmental issues that are of much import, and we have situations, I think, political situations, social situations, how might you take that notion of self-efficacy and provide experiences within the museum and within the public realm that lead to that notion of self-efficacy? And so for us, we now are dealing with behavioral sciences, and we're thinking about the environment. When we do outdoor exhibits, we might talk about how muddy the bay is or how turbid the bay is. But we also talk about the fact that the bay is clearing. And the reason the bay was muddy in the first place was that 150 years ago, they were mining using hydraulic nozzles, blowing away mountains. And so the bay is only now clearing from that past human activity. So it's always wrapping a little bit of narrative around the experience that give a more holistic understanding of what's going on. So when people get that full story, I think they start to realize that it's not just an exhibit about a thing. It's part of a much larger story, and they're able to explore it.
I also want to remind the audience, please, if you have questions, do submit them, because I don't want to be the only one asking questions. And I have a lot of them, because I just find it so fascinating, the idea of working together. Mark, when you walked into this project, what did you feel was your biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge, and well, my biggest fear, was that we would design a new Exploratorium and people would walk in the door and say, it's nice, but why did they move?
Yeah,
we didn't want to lose.
It was a nice space where you were. It was in the Marina, San Francisco Marina District, big open space, but it got crowded.
Yeah,
it did. The old Palace of Fine Arts was a narrower space. It was taller. It was darker. When you were in, you were really in. The new space shares a lot of the same qualities, but it's not as tall. It's wider. It has much better daylight, which was a great opportunity, but also presented its own challenges, but really gave us a great opportunity to create a canvas. And I think the Exploratorium is noted for, in the industry, we say they're not about the cabinet. They're not about designing gorgeous exhibits so much as they are about designing exhibits that are really meaningful, exhibits that you walk away from really having gained something profound. We wanted the architecture to do the same thing. it's kind of hard to describe that, but we wanted to create a canvas for the exhibits to happen, and we wanted to have a building that would be infinitely flexible into the future, because as Sean has already alluded to, and as Frank famously said years ago, it'll never be finished. This is an evolving institution, and the building needs to work with that and not fight that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why the word fighting comes to mind, but when you talk about a creative and collaborative process, you get two strong creative individuals. How did the creative process work, though, between the architect and the artist client? I'm sure it was a seamless process, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we started very early on with much more sort of broad planning about, you know, what this was going to be, talking about the galleries. The big difference with the new Exploratorium is there are more distinct galleries, which really helps in terms of finding one's way through the museum, helps with acoustics. But it's those kind of broad planning strokes were discussed very early on. And then as time went on and the design evolved, the discussions changed to be more discussions about detail and where things were going to go. I think my relationship with Sean has really developed more in the during construction and into the opening, because a lot of his work is such a scale where it didn't have a huge impact on the architecture, yet it interfaced with it probably more directly than the other exhibits, because as you saw with the bay windows exhibits, it's woven in so tightly you really can't tell that it wasn't that it was an exhibit or wasn't a piece of architecture. So that was really important in the beginning. And just having very open and candid discussions is always the most important thing, so that we really get to understand each other in a working process. That's paramount.
And Sean, for you, the creative process, working with the architect?
Well, they left a lot of opportunities out there. So that was really important for us to go into a place where we thought we could, and we had a plan to a point. But when we got there, a lot of things shifted. So the siding of, say, the Aeolian Harp, which is Doug Hollis's piece at the end of the piers, there's a small pedestrian bridge at the very end of the piers, and the piers are kind of far apart until they get to the end, and then there's an observatory building, which is this beautiful two-story glass structure, and it pinches down that airspace just enough to where the wind comes through and then accelerates through. So Doug's piece has been at the museum for over 30 years, and it used to be on the roof of the museum. The wind would come through, and it vibrates the strings, and the strings hummed, a beautiful kind of complex humming. And the sound was sent down wires and into plates, and those plates would be at about 8 feet up in the air. And then they would then vibrate the sound out. So at the new site, we mounted that harp directly on the bridge. It's about 25 feet tall. And it turns out we put the transducers at the end, so as you're standing at the end of the piers and the wind comes up, you hear this beautiful sound, and it's very evocative of the space itself. But you also found as you're standing on the bridge, the sound is being transferred into the bridge, and then the entire bridge is now vibrating in this very kind of mysterious sound. And so you're enveloped by this, and sometimes it's coming from every direction. And so, but having that bridge there and having the opportunity to mount that bridge was kind of the seed for that wonderful idea that's actually very old to take root in this new site. And so there are many times like that we found ourselves replacing things once we got on site, because the railings were easy to mount to, because the bridges were easy to mount to, because the decks were well designed. There's lots of space to move and work with the space. We also worked with the pier pilings. The pier pilings were left over. You know, we could have stripped that entire waterway in the middle out and had nothing left but water. But by leaving the pier pilings, there's probably 130, 140 pilings left over, and they were a couple feet above the high tide. And so as you look out into the bay and you might see a wave roll through, because the pilings are there, you have some kind of scale to compare it to. So you get a sense, you kind of get a sense of its animated, the animation of the bay. And then we put art piece out there that was Chris Bell's Sun Swarm. So Chris saw those pilings and said, oh, that's perfect. He mounted these redwood, recycled redwood posts with mirrors on them, 1,000 square mirrors on the pilings, and they're activated by the waves coming through. And the sun comes across, south-facing sun, and it bounces off that 1,000 mirrors, and it shines those mirrors, and they make little circles, little images of the sun all underneath Pier 17's railing from about until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's just mesmerizing, and we could not have done it unless those pilings were there for us to work with. So I think they always had this notion like, look, let's just give these guys some space. Don't over-constrain them, but let's not try to figure out what we're going to do too early.
The pilings are a great remnant of the past because they were part of the pier that had to go, but by leaving them there, it was less expensive than actually taking them out. and all the bridges that we've been talking about are actually built on those old pilings. So between supporting the bridges, supporting an infinite array of future exhibits, it's great to have them there. And when you're on site, they also let you know what the tide's doing because you can monitor. If you didn't have them there, you wouldn't be as familiar with where the tide is in its cycle.
That's right.
You see that part of the old Embarcadero that stayed. So you really get a sense of the history. But I think it also plays into something that is really getting a lot of attention with the new Exploratorium, and that is the idea of sustainability, that what you had there, you found ways to use some of the old and make it new again. Mm-hmm. So talk about that, the sustainability, the idea that a net zero building, that is your goal for this building.
Yeah, that was very exciting for us. I mean, just looking at the pier itself, it was always our objective, both from a sustainable and a design perspective, to not try to make the pier look new. The pier has a wonderful history, and we wanted to make sure that the public would always be able to see that. In terms of the net zero story, we decided very early on in the project that this would be a great candidate because of, you know, who the Exploratorium is within the science industry and because it's the right thing to do.
Continue.
It's important for a building that can, in this case, produce as much energy on site as it consumes within a calendar year. So this is our goal. This is where we started. And the way we're able to do that is because we have almost 2 acres of photovoltaic panels on the roof of this building, 5,900 panels. It's a 1.3 megawatt array. So that produces the energy, and we're able to minimize energy consumption by using the actual bay. Now, we've already talked about how we've used the bay for exhibits, but we're actually using it to heat and cool the building. So those are the two major things. We also, in any kind of a net zero energy project, you have to start with a super energy efficient building. So there are a lot of things that went into the design, like the high performance glass, that helps contribute to that.
We'll talk about some of those aspects in just a second.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and the New Exploratorium, a learning lab for the 21st century, featuring architect and designer Mark Littalian and senior artist Sean Lanie and Sidney Cohera, our own Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist, who's our moderator.
As we continue our conversation, I want to return to the idea of the sustainability. And one of the questions coming in from our audience, talking about using the bay water, and this question is about a slide that shows something like a drum made of white glass under a metal grid. Tell us more about that.
That's a filter.
I mean, you're using parts of the Exploratorium that are really just functioning infrastructure, and it's become an exhibit, right?
Mm-hmm. It has. We're able to use the bay water for heating and cooling because the temperature of the bay is fairly consistent throughout the course of the year. It varies about 15 degrees. So we bring in seawater, we filter it, and we run it through a heat exchanger, which parallels a loop inside the building, 40 miles of plastic pipe that both heats and cools the building depending on time of the year. And that's really wonderful because we're able to use a natural resource that's right there on site, but it also allowed us to have far less ductwork overhead. We still have some, and that's bringing in fresh air, but most of the climate control in the building is now handled beneath your feet. And I wish we could claim credit for the design of that. That was really started by the Romans years ago, but it's something that we've reintroduced into this project.
Just a quick question. This bracket, the black bracket, is that part of the heating cooling system?
That's part of the filtration system.
The filtration system.
And this, one of the wonderful things about this site is it's full of surprises. So I heard, maybe this isn't true, but I heard when we first kicked this system up, we were presuming a certain temperature range for the ocean. It turns out the South Bay warms up quite a bit. It's very shallow. And so the temperature changes were unexpected. And the cleaning of these things, you know, there's all sorts of fouling and biomass that happens. When you're so directly engaged with the environment, it will surprise you. It will do things you don't expect. And I think for us as exhibit developers, it's fantastic. Maybe not so fantastic when you're planning a building.
Yeah, the intakes are interesting because we were also the designers of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and when you have an intake line with marine organisms, those lines get fouled up, and they look like those cross sections you see at the doctor's office with their cholesterol like clogging up your arteries. And at the aquarium, they run these things called pigs through them, which cleans out all of the organisms. Here at the Exploratorium, instead, we have two lines. We close one down and just put fresh water into it, and then instantly the marine organisms fall off right away. So it's an easier way to take care of the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things, Sean, I want to address with you is the fact that a lot of these exhibits and a lot of what the Exploratorium is about is taking the message of learning and education to other parts of the world. Mm. And that these exhibits, there are a lot of partnerships that are going on with many of these exhibits. And I know with the National Oceanic mm-hmm. and Atmospheric Administration.
That's right.
You have some projects. Just talk about those a little bit and the partnerships that you have.
Yeah, we have a 10-year partnership with NOAA now, and it's already come to fruition with a couple different exhibits. For us to have access to that caliber of scientists is really fascinating.
And for most people, they would know it as the National Weather Service. I mean, for NOAA, a lot of the projects that they're involved in.
Well, it's a
weather, but
NOAA has a specific duty that they perform. It's everything between the ocean and the sky. And if you think about the agencies and the jobs that they're doing now, it's incredibly important as they create these networks of sensors. In some ways, they're forming a nervous system for the entire world. They're trying to get feedback on what's going on out there. And what they're finding is most of these systems are inextricably linked. There's no study of this and then the study of that. The questions lead towards each other. And so for us as an institution to be able to engage in that sort of broad breadth of research with a whole variety of scientists allows us to kind of work on a broad scale but then work on a very specific scale. So, for instance, we built something we call the Remote Rains Exhibit. And we worked with a person, David Kingsmill, who studies raindrops, raindrop sizes, raindrop frequencies. And we were able to get a distrometer that could capture the information from a storm. How many drops, how big were they, and how fast were they moving? And then we engineered an exhibit where you could recreate storms. We have a storm we recreated from Taipei 10 years ago, a storm from Australia, a storm from Oregon coast. And it's not just replicating storms. It's getting to the causality of these storms. So one of the things David studies specifically is rainstorms along mountain ranges. Rain rates along mountain ranges are extremely heavy, but the drop size is very small. And so when we kick up that mountain storm, you can get very wet with some very small drops because there's so many of them. So he's studying these atmospheric rivers and seeing how it affects the overall rainfall, the overall snowpack. And this has a huge impact on our water supply. What's driving these changes in the environment? But by inviting people in, this, like I talked about that level of engagement, by inviting people in to an experience which is it's just raining, and you can have an umbrella, and you can run around, you can change the storms, but then we start getting to the causality and the research behind it. And so you're extending that experience. You're starting to change how they're understanding storms conceptually. And from that point forward, we hope that they start to think about their own observations in a slightly different way.
Part of the beauty of this wonderful museum is the fact that you don't have to actually pay to be a part of what you're doing. Let's talk about not only what you have inside, but talk about what is available to in the public space for everyone.
Yeah, we were really intrigued with the public spaces at the new site. The relationship you have with visitors when it's unticketed is a little different from when it's ticketed. There's not that set of expectations. You know, we're located between Pier 39 and the ferry building, is what we call the Silk Route of San Francisco. You have unbelievable flow of languages and people and types of people and activities are all over the place. And so we put a great great amount of effort in activating these spaces so that people coming by, you know, not everybody knows the Exploratorium when they're not from here. And so you have to form that relationship early. What you're seeing up on the screen here is the central area, which is actually the ticketed area, but you can see that from a nearby unticketed area. There are numerous exhibits. The piece that I mentioned before, Chris Bell's piece, is on the unticketed side as you walk down Pier 17. And we wanted to make sure that nobody ever felt abandoned just because they hadn't paid for entry. And it was really a way of activating that space and trying to change the civic relationship that the museum has with the city. It's an everyday thing. We want to be a part of your everyday lives. And it's a really easy exchange. We have explainers out there. And one came up to me the other day and she said, you know, you never know what's going to happen here. You really don't ever know. And they all have lists of stories about people that they've interacted with. And it wasn't like that in the marina. You know, you kind of know what you're going to get in the marina generally. It's a much different part of the city. This is a very vibrant part of the city. So for us to interface with it is just, this is a constant surprise.
Yeah, I think that central space is one of my favorite spaces in the project. And early on when we were meeting with the city and the port and talking about the signage, there were a lot of restrictions about what we could and couldn't do. But for all the reasons that Sean just described, that central space is really abuzz with activity. Between the explainers, the carts, the exhibits, the people, it actually ends up being the marquee. So you don't need a sign. And I hope that the general public can have that same experience that I had over 20 years ago with the doors open and just like, what is this place? Yeah. And you're completely drawn in.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about this one. Part of the outside of the building is, it looks like designs of algae. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, you really incorporated the idea of the water into actual pieces of the structure.
Yeah, you're looking at an image of what we call the plankton wall, and it is they're stainless steel panels, and they're perforated, magnified images of the phytoplankton that exists in the water beneath your feet. And this is important for a couple of reasons. One is it's ornament, but it's not ornament for ornament's sake. It's ornament that was really driven by the mission and the exhibit, so it wasn't arbitrary. The other thing is the new architecture looks very different than the old, so they need to be in stark contrast with one another. And this plankton wall exists in what we call the hyphen. It's the transition between the 1930s and 2013.
I was walking by a high school the other day, and they had on the wall Socrates, and Da Vinci, you know, the name is. We put plankton on our wall.
Yeah. Well, how did this idea come about? I mean, obviously, this was a great collaboration.
I don't know who. Probably our microscopy lab. They take unbelievably beautiful images of what my colleague calls a charismatic microfauna. So they're samples from the bay, and we're so invested in studying the mysteries of the bay and making sure that people know that the bay is actually extremely dynamic. It's constantly changing, and it's being studied actively by the Romberg-Tiburon Center, by Berkeley, by Stanford, by scientists all over the Bay Area trying to understand this ecology that we live in. And so many of our exhibits, as you experience them, the underlying impact we're hoping to have is just to get people to realize that what a wonderful mystery that they live on, and that it's under study, and it's worth taking a second look at.
So this is actually one of those great moments of collaboration where you have scientists. There was an artist involved in this, Mark McGowan, who was involved with a lot of the graphics. And you have the people on our team who had to figure out how this was actually going to be made, what the material was going to be. So a lot of people behind the scenes to make something come together, which looks pretty simple when you first see it, but the more you dig, it's really fascinating.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and the new Exploratorium, a learning lab for the 21st century, with Sydney Kohara, who's our moderator and our award-winning broadcast journalist, Mark Littalian, who is our architect and designer from EHDD, and our senior artist, Sean Linnae, who is from the Exploratorium and who's telling us all about these wonderful discoveries and artwork.
As we continue about collaboration at the Exploratorium, there is a back wall at the building that really is like the pilings, and the old piers that you decided to keep when you could have covered it up. Tell us this story.
Well, this is very important. This is indicative of that, what I was explaining earlier about really wanting to reveal the past. And when we first came upon this end of the building, it had a lot of peeling paint. We scraped off that first layer and started to find the sort of ghosted images of these signs from the past. And the normal way to handle this would have been to sort of sandblast off the paint, but when we started to do that, we were sandblasting off the signs. So that wasn't going to work. So, you know, the schedule's ticking along and there's a lot of pressure to just keep things moving. The simple solution would have been to just give it a lick of paint and we can just be on our way. We really wanted to make sure that these signs were preserved for posterity. So we did a very painstaking mechanical removal process of all the remaining layers of paint, which necessitated covering up that end of the facade, taking a few extra weeks to do that, and then once they were revealed, to seal them in place. And what we're left with is not one particular sign, but many signs painted over many different years. Some you can read really clearly, and some kind of fade into the past. And we thought that was kind of a really interesting canvas to tell the story of how many companies occupied these piers, and it makes for a really subtle but beautiful graphic at the end of the building.
Sean, were you part of this as well,
no,
making
I,
that decision?
No, I loved it, though. I thought it was a great. And for me, when you work in a place like this, it's just like the palace. You could never imagine it being anything else but the Exploratorium. But places evolve. They have life. They have lifespans. People will come and they go. So it's nice to see a little history left from behind. I've always thought we should be able to sign our apartments that you live in San Francisco. Just have a little section in the wall in every apartment for people who live there, a little date.
They don't do that?
No. Well, they always paint over it.
You know, some people, they put their handprint in the cement
right.
in the, on the driveway.
Right.
It's a great idea. Museums are always faced with the issue of how do you remain relevant, interesting, and rewarding for people. I know one of our questions today from the audience is how, in the interest of exposing more children to science, say like the California Academy of Sciences does by allowing a member to bring a guest, you know, how do you help them remain relevant but make it open as far as the fee structure? What are the fees for the Exploratorium?
So we have an interesting fee structure. We are actually one of the lowest overall average costs of the institutions of all sort in the United States. So it's a $25 fee for adults, but it's discounted to $20 for any of the 9 county areas in the area. So we're bringing over the same fee structures we had at the Palace to our new site. We also heavily discount for kids and school groups. So we're very aware that that price can be a barrier for people, and we're very determined to make sure that it's not a barrier to bring people in. But I think more than that, it's more than just bringing people to the Exploratorium. It's about engaging those communities in a more direct and meaningful way. So we've recently gotten funding from the National Science Foundation to work with the Boys and Girls Club over in the Mission. And so we're actually working on a design and build project with a very large group. And the thing about the Exploratorium to remember, I think, is when we do these projects, they're for the local communities. But we're also trying to capture and model things that museums can do elsewhere. We want to be a national or international model so that what we do as an R&D center propagates and that the relevance isn't just with the immediate success or impact. It's about how it might echo through the industry.
This space, not only do you have the free open public spaces, but you have also incorporated some incredible spaces for restaurants and events. And let's talk about that. I know one that is really fascinating is the observatory. Mm. So let's talk about that from not only the architectural standpoint, but how the design came about.
This is another one of those very collaborative moments in the project, and the Exploratorium wanted a place where they could have great views of the bay and of the city. So that started to determine where this building would be located and about how big it would be. It was always the mandate that this would be first and foremost a fabulous exhibit space for viewing, but it would also double as an event space in the evening. Doing a glass box is a great idea, but when you're trying to do a net zero energy building, it poses some challenges. We have on the surface of the glass what's known as a ceramic frit, and the frit basically reflects heat gain so that it doesn't get trapped in the building. And typically when you're looking through these things, it can be a bit oppressive if you don't have any relief from them. And when we were working with Susan Schwarzenberg and her team who were developing the exhibits in that part of the building, they understood the need for the frit and that it needed to be there, but it was like, well, can you just move it out of the way of the view? Because we don't want to have to actually look through it. So we had some great discussions about
the clear part.
That's the clear part. So we actually ended up creating a clear band around eye level around the entire building, which forced us to increase the density in other places. But it's actually it's a beautiful way to accomplish what they needed to accomplish. It ends up having a very characteristic look on the outside, so it's not arbitrary. Again, it's driven by this collaboration and need for very specific views. So it gives the building a certain sensibility from the outside.
And the fact that, I mean, were you ever worried about bird strikes having all of that glass around?
Yeah, that's another benefit is, first of all, one of the main causes for bird strikes is when you have landscape elements or trees close to a building that's reflective. We don't have any of that on this project. But the other reason is reflectivity and transparency of the glass, which causes problems for bird strikes. So in this case, the frit actually helps on the reflectivity issue, and it really helps on the transparency issue.
Sean, let's talk about the exhibits and as far as which ones are permanent. There's always an ever-evolving sort of change of exhibit. You have the permanent ones, but talk about some that are the revolving exhibits. I know that you have what you call a movable feast of exhibits, like what did you call them, Dutch bikes?
Oh, yeah, the Dutch bikes. Yeah, we were trying to figure out where best to put certain kinds of activities, like the membership card, the admissions card, the explainer card. And looking at the model, looking at the SketchUp model, looking at the site, we said, you know, we should just put these things on bikes. If they're on bikes, then we can move them later and adjust to the site. And so we got these Dutch bikes. They're just beautiful, you know, 1,500-pound load bikes. And we started to put exhibits on them and build infrastructure for the museum so they could kind of roll around and engage people in the right spot. And it turned out to be a bit of a statement, too, because when people come every other time or whenever they come, there's always a slightly different configuration. So like Mark said, it's kind of always moving and changing. And so the Loretta Keller and the Sea Glass restaurant got the same idea for their food carts and their amazing ice cream cart and their coffee cart in the back deck. So now they're moving around to see where people go and where people want them. So it's a very charming way, I think, to present things because it's a transient, and it's a bit like having somebody just roll by.
For your temporary exhibits, how long did they stay?
Oh, as little as a couple minutes. I've seen some last 10 minutes, and then you kind of shamefully drag them back to the shop. And
What have you observed in the first few weeks that you have officially been open?
Oh, okay.
Good and bad.
Yeah. Well, we we try to extend that lifetime out. We do a lot of early prototyping with exhibits. We very much want the visitors to help us figure out what it is what best works on the floor. It's really the most interesting thing in that entire museum is any given visitor. They're extremely complex. Everybody comes with a different set of expectations. And the way they interact with things is, even as a designer, after all these years, you're just constantly surprised. And so what we've done is we've revamped over 450 of our exhibits. They just look beautiful. They're well-lit. They're well-placed. They're very thoughtful in how they're grouped so that you can make associations without kind of being taken through a rote curriculum. But there is a curriculum there by grouping these types of exhibits together. And then we have new exhibits which have been prototyped over the last couple years, and they've been prototyped on our floor at the old museum. So the wonderful and crazy thing was that we were only closed 100 days between we closed the old museum and we opened the new museum. So it was extremely fast, and we knew, and in fact, I think it was the best way to do it. It made us want to be more nimble. It made us want to adjust and know that we're coming in and we're just going to take an opening gambit. And that opening gambit is going to look like this, and then we're going to adjust based on what we know. It's how we've always worked. It's how we work best. And so the more permanent exhibits, are the ones that are now getting through. I see the work all the time when you go on the floor. You see evaluators out there, you see the scientists, you see the developers, and there's labels with white pieces of paper over them and a marker pen, and they're trying different titles, and they're trying different arrows, and you're standing around watching visitors for a couple minutes, and you try something else. So many of those exhibits are evolving because now we have a floor at the new site, which changes things. So, and this will go on for the next, you know, 30 years, 40 years.
I know one of the big hits of the Exploratorium has always been this giant parabolic dish.
Oh, yeah.
And I know when we were all there, we all stood in front of it for about 5 minutes. What is it? Describe it and why it's so popular.
So that thing is crazy. It's just a big mirror. It's about 9 feet wide and about 6 feet tall. And it's not quite parabolic. It's hemispherical. And it's a donation we got. We had it on the old museum floor for a very short amount of time. And then we boxed it back up and we put it away. We thought we have to use this thing. Because what happens in it is really, it's really surprising. Everybody knows the experience with a mirror. This mirror, as you walk towards it, one of the odd things is everything is in focus. And you kind of see yourself bobbing along. And then as you approach towards the center of the mirror, you see your head in the mirror, except it's now in front of the mirror. It's a virtual image. And you can reach out, and it looks like a hand is reaching out from the mirror, and your hands cross over each other. It's just so strangely jarring. Like, I know a mirror. I don't have to tell me what a mirror does. And yet this thing is doing things I've never seen before. So experiences like that become profound because they start engendering questions like, what is it about this mirror? And what happens if? And so what you see is this amazing dance of visitors in front of this mirror. And if you were to look at them without the mirror, you'd think people are all crazy. They're moving their arms around and they're giggling and they're taking pictures from low angles. But what they're really doing is they're trying to figure this thing out through play. And this object doesn't need a lot to have people do that. It's like a little piece of magic. It just does what it does and people do what they do. And what happens in the end is this wonderful exploration.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, The New Exploratorium, a learning lab for the 21st century, featuring our senior artists, Sean Loney and Mark Letalian, our designer and architect, and Sydney Cohera, our broadcast learning journalist and moderator. I actually have a question. Do I get to ask a question?
Absolutely. You're the boss.
I'm very interested in what kinds of thoughts and plans you made architecturally and in your programs for children with special needs, Down syndromes, autism, and that kind of spectrum that we are seeing so much of now today.
Yeah. We have had special events in the past at the old museum where time is set aside. There's certain times where we're quieter, and we understand that There's needs, such as autistic children. It's an overwhelming experience in the old museum if there were more than just a couple thousand people a day. It was loud, it was chaotic, it was difficult to find your way through. At the new site, there are many quiet sites. There's many quiet spots that you can go to. The galleries kind of expand and then they contract. They expand and they can contract. So what that allows for visitors with special needs is to find a corner, to find the rocking chairs on the east side that just look out over the water. If you need to get away from people, you can get away from people and have a little bit of space to yourself. It makes it a lot easier, I think, to navigate a museum like ours when you have those little cubby holes.
And you can see the space. You can see all the way to the end of the pier. Mark, was that deliberate to create that long sort of tunnel-like to where you could branch off if you want to find those private spaces?
Absolutely. We call that the nave, to be able to see the kind of shotgun view all the way through the pier. That was very deliberate, and we knew that in breaking up and setting up distinct galleries that we wanted the visitor to always be aware that, like the Palace of Fine Arts, you were in one large continuous space. So that was intentional. And following along with what Sean was just saying, the other thing that's uniquely different about the new site is that it's been called by the Exploratorium their campus. And it's not just a building. It is a series of experiences, including a building. And that's profound because when you're in the Exploratorium, you can find these little getaways, the little cubby to get away to, that you have much more of an awareness of what's going on the outside. And you can actually leave the building for a while and come back. You can go grab a bite to eat and come back. Very different set of experiences than what you were able to do at the Palace of Fine Arts. And this is great for holding attention, extending stay time, and just making for an overall much more enriching experience during your visit.
One of the things, Sean, you mentioned is the fact that people get so fascinated, say, by the giant parabolic dish. Hmm. What I find fascinating is that most of the people who are jumping up and down in front of it are adults.
Yeah.
That you find as many or more adults who were sort of losing themselves back into their childhood of just wonderment and learning. Yeah. Talk about your experience. And then also, Mark, I've seen you in there as well. What is it about the Exploratorium that gets people just they forget who they are?
They do forget. I was in the tinkering studio a couple of weeks ago with my little daughter, and there was a guy in there. He's probably in his late 60s, early 70s. And he was walking around, and they have a little beautiful exhibit there where a laminar flow of air comes up through a tube. And people are invited to cut little figures out of paper, and they float. And you can do all sorts of experiments, make them rotate, make them fall. And it's a semi-guided mediation with the tinkering studio. And he was very much in charge of helping people around. And I thought, well, that's really nice. A volunteer came in. And Mike Petrich, who runs the tinkering studio, he says, you know, that guy came here 2 years ago, or two hours ago. And he came in here, he folded his arm, and he says, I don't do this kind of thing. It's not what I do. I don't like it. He had his little girl, or his little granddaughter there. And he wouldn't leave. He wouldn't leave. And I think it's such an easy entryway into what's going on. And I think people want to play. They really, they want to have those experiences. And I think what the Exploratorium does is it makes it so consistently okay that it just breaks you down. It's like, okay, I'll try it. If I have to, I'll try it.
And then you can't get them away from it, right?
And you can't stop them, yeah, because it really is a human thing. It's a wonderful experience.
Well, I mean, people don't realize. They think, oh, the Exploratorium is for children, but really a lot of your membership, your audience, they're adults.
Sure, 60% of our visitors before at the old location came there without kids. And so we've always had an adult audience. Maybe it's a secret, but it really is. It's a wonderful – we actually have Thursday nights are adults only in our place. And they're fantastic. It's not that we don't like kids, but it changes the venue a little bit. And it's there's so many points of interaction. I was talking to somebody in the restaurant towards the end of the previous night, and he said, you know, I've met so many people here. Because so many of the exhibits are based on having one or more people, two or three people interact. And so you end up kind of being forced to exchange in a way that you're not used to. And you're busy playing, so, you know, you can kind of not worry about the things that you normally worry about.
So all of a sudden, the Exploratorium has become sort of the adult, hip and happening hotspot in San Francisco. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah,
so every Thursday?
Yeah. I would highly suggest it. Yeah. That's all I could say.
Mark, for you to be able to walk into a building that has been the heart and soul of your work for so many years, are you like a kid in there as well? Or do you start looking at the little details?
Well, far less of the little details these days, but because it's such a big project and it's still ongoing for us, it's been a bit of a torture for me because I haven't been able to do that yet. And it's killing me because there's all sorts of new stuff I want to check out. And the other thing that makes it so great is because there's no sequence, there's no order to do things in. You see people kind of bounce from one exhibit to the next. That's the beauty of Exploratorium, and that's what I miss. I'm really anxious to wrap up our work so that I can go and be a kid and explore. I'm a tinker at heart, and it's such a wonderful place to be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, both of you have been birthing this baby for a long, long time, haven't you?
Yeah.
But it is it's a work in progress. I do have to ask this question. It's coming from the audience, but the New York Times had a bit of a lukewarm reception to the new museum. Your comments, your thoughts on that?
Well, never critique a critic, that's a dangerous thing. I think it was for me. The place-based learning was so central to one of the initiatives we're trying to do, the observatory, the work in the East Gallery. That's really about a specific place, and even in the West Gallery, the work with behavioral sciences. I think is extremely important for the museum to move into, because we want to increase our relevance. You know, we experiment as a habit, and so I think Ed, he might have said. I think to the end where it's a little, maybe it's a little undercooked, or maybe it's not, maybe that wasn't quite exactly the right thing, but we're completely okay with that. In fact, we would prefer to be there than you hit a home run, guys, you're just like you used to be. You did exactly what I thought you'd do. I'd rather be on that hairy edge. I think as an institution, we prefer that zone. And we're going to get better at it because we trust our visitors to help us get better at it.
And Mark, when you look at this and all of the design details, is there something you would have changed going back now, or is there something you'd like to see added in the future?
I think just to have it evolve in its own course. I mean, we went through a lot of changes during the process, and changes in the middle of a design process are sometimes very difficult because you resist it. You think you had the right idea. And I think,
like the lights in the back, I remember you told me about that.
Yeah,
tell us quickly about that.
Oh, the lights. Yeah, we have these lights that are lighting the pier, and they're really beautiful lamps when you see them on the building. But when we first had the sample brought into the office, it was about as long as this table. And it got set down. I said, you got to be kidding me. We're not going to put this on the building. It just seemed so out of scale because it was on our table in the office. But you put it on this building that's the length of a New York City block, it looks perfectly scaled. So.
How many exhibits? We have, 600 exhibits,
yeah.
150 that are brand new here.
Yeah.
Sean, do you have one that is your favorite? If we are going to walk into the Exploratorium, adult or child,
it's such a hard question.
And you get to play with all of them, right?
Let me give you a non-answer. The non-answer is, I'm always shocked by a person's favorite exhibit. Everybody that goes to the museum, especially habitually, they'll say, that's my favorite exhibit. And it's almost always a different exhibit. And what you come to realize is many times it's a particular experience they have with that exhibit that's very personal. It's something that they kind of haven't completely resolved, but they enjoy the activity of it. So for me, when I was younger, I would play with the magnet, the two horseshoe-shaped magnets, and it has the black sand from Ocean Beach. You would troll Ocean Beach, right? And it's such a tactile feeling. It feels like you're gripping the magnetic field lines. They're completely invisible, and yet you can feel those forces. So you're playing with something that was otherwise all in your head, and now it's been manifest in some way. And that was a very powerful experience for me as a child. And so I'm still drawn back to that simple little exhibit. But everybody you ask on staff, every visitor, they generally have some that they like a lot. But the absolute favorite almost always wanders piece to piece because it's deeply personal.
When we were walking through a couple of weeks ago, remember, was it the building manager who had been there?
Yeah, Nibby. It was a Nibby manager there, yeah.
Who had been through the whole building process. What was he doing?
Well, we
just chuckled about that.
Yeah, this wonderful piece called the Canterbury Arch Bridge, and you lay down the piece of wood, and then you stack up this arch, and then you slowly pick the piece of wood up, lifts the arch up in the air, and then you lift the wood back, and the arch stays suspended like this. It's a very elegant, but it's a very simple thing. And he was taking such care in doing it just right. And he was stacking up all the, and he was so intent on it. And I thought, this guy's in charge of the whole building, like this whole thing. And he's like, he cared so deeply about what, and then he got it up, and then he was proud. He was proud. And I thought, well, that's nice.
And this is the person who put the whole building together.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, this should be a slam dunk. But there was something in the way that the exhibit was set up. And I've seen 6- and 7-year-olds do that exhibit with just as much pride. So there's something kind of surprising that it works, even for somebody that advanced.
For both of you, as we come to the end of our program, this is really an element of street performance in a way. You've got the Exploratorium, you've got the free space, you've got this incredible amount of activity. What do you hope people will take away from their experience?
Well, I go back.
What do you
a
hope
bit.
They go into the door yeah. with and come out?
I mean, we have a term that we call an animated aftermath. It's an animated aftermath of an experience. So what happens at an object? And we usually use this in the public realm with environmental exhibits, but I think it's also true of the whole museum, is that the museum experience should somehow change how you see the world or how you approach the world. So the benefit of those experiences doesn't stay at the museum. You take it with you. And in some ways, you come back to the museum to kind of recharge. And we want to make sure that we're part of the dialogue that's ongoing. We want to be part of the larger conversations that happen in San Francisco. So really that, for me, that it's a holistic goal. That's about changing and really empowering people to be their own advocates.
And Mark, for you?
I think for me it's between the exhibits and the building for people to go away and have had a moment where their preconceptions were suspended. Mm-hmm. And whether they know a lot about museums or knew a lot about the Exploratorium, that they've come to this place and it's not what they expected. And as a designer, I can say that there are a lot of things in this project that turned out very differently than what we envisioned, but they're no less powerful and really meaningful to us. I hope that the public can experience the same thing.
And Sean, before I let you, what is next for the Exploratorium as you evolve, as you move forward?
Now, we've launched so many nascent efforts now, like with the environment, with the observatory, with the partnerships, local scientists and local educators. We are moving in a lot of different directions right now, and I think it all goes back to relevancy. How do you remain relevant as a cultural institution? How do you stay a part of the conversation and impact people, both locally and nationally? So I see all these areas of new explorations, they're just starting.
If Frank Oppenheimer could see this today, what do you think he would say?
Keep going. Keep going. You're not finished yet. You're never finished. He was a great nudger, I've heard. He was a benevolent dictator. And I think that kind of helpful nudging and making sure that you stay on task, remember it is what you're doing and why, it still echoes to the museum.
The Exploratorium, a learning laboratory for the 21st century. Mark Letellian?
Oh, excuse me.
Sean Lanny, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Actually, we've reached that point in our program for a last question, and I get to ask it. So I'm going to Sydney and Mark. I'm not going to let Sydney off the hook. Sydney, okay. Mark, and Sean. And if you were a six-year-old today going into the Exploratorium, what's the one place you'd head to first?
We are six-year-olds at heart. We just can't let everybody
know. We're all six-year-olds.
Besides a coffee cart. Yeah. I'd probably run outside. I'm a big outside person, so I would and not for any one exhibit, just to be in that space is just it's really fun.
Great. I think for me, the parabolic dish was just fascinating to me. I mean, having been on television for so many years, and to see yourself sort of moving around and watching other people and just being so in focus, but it was just, I would never have been that close to anything like that. That and the Sean, what is the one with the fog and the steam going up?
The fog bridge.
Yes.
Yeah. Or the tornado.
Yes, the tornado is also
yes.
A good one.
Yeah.
I will push those little kids out of the way to play with that one. In a nice way, though.
Of course. About
you, Mark?
Yeah, of course.
My answer is the same as an adult as it would be as myself at six, but I would want to climb into the gyroid, and I still haven't had the opportunity to do it yet.
You haven't been in the gyroid? See, we never grow old.
No. And the Exploratorium is open, so they can go and do that today.
That's true.
Thanks to our moderator, Sydney Kohara, Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist, and our speakers, architect Mark Letellian, and our wonderful artist who is with us, Sean Lanny, for this wonderful experience of learning about the Exploratorium and all the wonderful things that go on there. I want to remind everyone that we do have our final New Visions program on May 22nd about greening sports, so we invite you to come on May 22nd. And I also want to invite you to all of the programs that are coming up at the Commonwealth Club. Now, I'm proud to tell you that I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.